Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Cahuilla Delta Medical Center, and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Renita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, the U.S. Postal Service is taking drastic measures in order to stay afloat. The cuts could impact everyone's mail deliveries, and for some cities, like Bakersfield, it could mean a loss of jobs. And all you have to do is look at downtown Fresno to see how the city is spending some of its redevelopment money. What happens now that the courts say the state can have those funds? Plus, an organization that is there for families during a time of loss needs your help. But first, the U.S. Postal Service is proposing to lay off thousands of workers, close hundreds of post offices and processing facilities, plus cut Saturday mail delivery, all to stay in business. Officials are recommending at least 13 processing facilities in California be closed or consolidated. One of those facilities is located in Bakersfield. Officials say closing the Bakersfield facility and sending the mail 80 miles away to Santa Clarita to be processed would save them $10 million a year. What do you think about the Postal Service's efforts to save money and stay in business? Do you think the U.S. Postal Service is still needed? You can call us at 800-224-8989, 559-275-8989, or online at kvpr.org. But here to discuss the possible impacts is James Wigdell, U.S. Post Office Communications, and American and Russell Johnson, Bakersfield City Councilman. We will also hear from Omar Gonzalez, a Western Region Coordinator with the American Postal Workers. Let's start with you, Mr. Wigdell. First of all, thanks a lot for joining us this morning.
It's my pleasure.
No problem.
And you too, Mr. Johnson. Thanks for joining us as well. Mr. Wigdell, first, I'd like for you to give our listeners an idea of what the Postal Service is facing financially.
We're facing a dire financial situation. We have been experiencing a dramatic loss in mail volume over the past 4 or 5 years. Actually, 27% of our first-class mail volume has gone away. And this, of course, has caused a dramatic drop in our revenue at the same time. Last year, we had a net loss of $5.1 billion. The year before that, $8.5 billion. And we're looking at a loss of possibly $14 billion this year. And this is forcing the Postal Service to take some very dramatic measures to, A, right-size the postal network, and, B, keep the post office sustainable for the long term.
And what went into the organization's decision to target the Bakersfield facility for closure? When you took a look at processing centers around the state, what went into some of the decisions to target Bakersfield and some of the others?
Well, we looked at Bakersfield and the others around the state and their proximity to other mail processing facilities. The Bakersfield mail processing facility is approximately 80 or so miles from the Santa Clarita processing facility, which is a much larger facility, and we feel that the Santa Clarita facility can accommodate the mail processing operations that currently take place in Bakersfield.
But, you know, if you send mail 80 miles away to Santa Clarita to be processed, I mean, it's got to slow down the mail delivery.
Well, what we're doing is back in September, we announced that we were going to be looking at about 250 mail processing centers out of almost 500 nationwide as a major restructuring of our network, our processing delivery network. And in order to close 250 plants, half of our plants almost, we also had to look at changing our service standards. So the service, if this was to go through, it not only would affect Bakersfield, but every location in the United States, we would have to change our service standards from the expectation of overnight delivery in the local area to a 2 to 3 day delivery in the local area.
I would like to bring in now Russell Johnson, Bakersfield City Councilman. You know, what will this mean to the city of Bakersfield?
Well, this is a significant move, and thank you for having me on. The city of Bakersfield is the ninth largest city in the state of California, And we're bigger than Santa Clarita. We're bigger than the city of Santa Ana. And everyone knows the federal government has to make changes and the Postal Service has to make changes. But we think that this is the wrong change. The city of Bakersfield alone sends over 300,000 pieces of first-class mail, as well as additional certified mail. Governmental agencies have timelines that they have to meet. They have to send certain notices on certain timelines. And this change is dramatically going to change the way that we have to do business. And we think that the post office, in moving the facility from Bakersfield and moving it to Santa Clarita, it's the wrong move. I mean, Bakersfield's a growing area. We're the ninth largest city in the state. When you add in our unincorporated county areas within the city of around the city of Bakersfield, we're almost 500,000 people. And as a growing community, the post office is only going to be bringing that processing facility back probably in the future, not taking it away. So all those factors combined with the fact that if you move the postal processing to Santa Clarita and the Postal Service moves to a 2 to 3 day delivery option and they have to service that mail within 2 to 3 days, what happens when there's problems on the Grapevine and they end up having to close the Ridge Route and the Postal Service can't meet their 2 to 3 day delivery time frame? And we think all those problems combined that the Postal Service is making the wrong decision for the community of Bakersfield.
Have you looked at other options? I'm sure, as I know, there are a number of hearings on this issue. What did you propose? What alternative did you propose to the post office?
Well, at the hearing, I made the point that, hey, you know, Bakersfield, we're the ninth largest city in the state, and to move the processing facility out of here is a bad idea. And we basically told them that if they do this move to a 2 to 3 day option and they move their processing out of town, you know, our jurisdiction as the city of Bakersfield is going to have to look how we do our first-class mail and try to find other ways, possibly, to get our notifications out, which this is one thing that the Postal Service is not talking about. They mentioned at the hearing that for every piece of first-class mail, it's worth 3 pieces of business-class mail. So that means that first-class mail is a higher profit center than the business-class area. And yet, they're moving to 2 to 3 day delivery structure and driving people away from their first-class mail option. If that's your profit center, why is the Postal Service driving people away from them? I think that's another point that needs to be discussed, and the Postal Service didn't really address that adequately.
You know, Mr. Wigdell, that's also one of the arguments that I've also heard, is that, you know, the Postal Service right now is going through a very delicate time. It is losing money. But if you make these closures, it will only, perhaps there's the argument that it will just slow the mail even more and drive people away, leaving you in a tougher situation.
Yeah, I totally agree that our first class mail product it's been our bread and butter for since the advent of the Postal Service, basically. But the problem is our first class mail product is going away. Again, as I said earlier, about 27% reduction in first class mail since 2006. So with a reduction in first class mail and all of these mail processing centers around the country, not just in Bakersfield but around the country, are designed basically to process first-class mail. We collect it during the day, we process it during the evening, and then we prepare it for delivery for the next day. But that product is going away, and we do not need as big a network as we have had. 2006 was our best year ever as far as mail processing goes, and then since then it's just gone down every year. In 2006, we processed 213 billion pieces of mail. Last year, we processed 165 billion pieces. So you can see that the drop off is there. And again, it's not a regional decision that's been made. This is a national change. We're looking at changing the entire network nationally. Currently, we process mail for delivery about 6 hours a night. We're looking at changing that to about 20 hours a day so that we can take advantage of the existing equipment and consolidate operations.
Okay. You also, this whole project or process has been put on hold, all of these changes were supposed to, I think, take place earlier this year. Now it's been put off to later on until May at the request of a group of senators. Now, they're saying, no, don't do this. But have they come up with any alternatives for you?
Well, that's one of the reasons why the delay was put in place. It's designed to allow Congress sufficient time to hopefully enact some comprehensive postal legislation. It's a chance for everybody to take a step backward, look at not only the possible closing of mail processing centers, but also post offices nationwide. As you possibly know, we also announced that we were looking at about 3,600 post offices nationwide for possible closure, not just the mail processing. So there's bills in the House, bills in the Senate. There's discussions taking place at a very high level, and hopefully we'll see some relief from Congress in the next couple of months.
Also, Mr. Wigdall, I have this question. Do you think the Postal Service is also dealing with a image problem? You know, for years it was part of the government, but that is not the case anymore. I mean, you don't receive any tax dollars for operating expenses. And you've mentioned and detailed, you know, just the big drop off and the fact that people aren't mailing as much anymore due to online banking and email, and that you really rely on stamps and other products. But do you think people still have this image that you know, you're a government agency receiving tax money, and if you can't balance your budget, that's your problem?
Well, we get that a lot. That's a big misconception out there that, you know, people think that we do receive taxpayer dollars, which we do not. Everything is from the sale of postal services and products. And that's part of our situation, in that we have to be able to operate more like a business, yet we're constrained by many regulations and rules from Congress, for example, going from 6 to 5 day delivery and things like that. So, you know, we're working as hard as we can to sustain the post office for the long term. We want to be able to take about $20 billion worth of costs out of the system by 2013. And at the same time, maintain our service. Granted, going from overnight to 2 to 3 days in a local area could you know, be significant for a number of constituents. However, we feel that the vast majority of people, I mean, people just are not getting letters in the mail anymore. They're getting advertising mail or perhaps some people still getting bills and that sort of thing. And as we work with our mailers to minimize that impact, we feel that by reducing the size of the network, will reduce our costs and also serve as sustainable for the long term.
Okay, I would also like to bring in Mr. Omar Gonzalez. He is the Western Region Coordinator with the American Postal Workers Union. Now, the closure of the Bakersfield facility it's my understanding that right now it hires about 289 employees or more than that, but 289 employees would lose their jobs. What does that mean? What alternatives do your workers have?
Well, as far as alternatives, the employees would be reassigned, which...
Let me go ahead and correct this. It says the closure, 138 of the 289 employees will lose their jobs. So
that's correct.
And so it's my understanding that some of those would get the opportunity to work in the other processing plant in Santa Clarita.
Well, they would be reassigned, which is why we question the supposed savings, employee savings that the Postal Service has issued publicly of $5 million savings in employee cost. How do they derive at that figure? And, of course, the lack of transparency is an issue in most of these hearings. They don't give the public the information. They don't come up with answers as to how they came up with these figures. How are you going to save $5 million in employee savings if you're going to reassign the employees? They keep saying, oh, no employee will lose their job. We'll just reassign them. Well, then where are the savings?
But it also, Mr. Gonzalez, what is their alternative? You have to look at the situation. Like many times have changed. And the fact that they're losing money has been well documented. Their financial situation has been well documented.
Well, the issue of the recent years of losing $14 billion, they didn't lose that money. It's been taken from them. This is a congressional manufactured issue. And then you top that off with the Postal Service outsourcing $12 billion worth of work that can be done internally. All this was actually as a result of a 2006 law signed into legislation signed into law by President Bush as a result of his presidential commissions that forces the Postal Service in 10 years to pay 75 years into the future for employee retirement benefits. We're actually paying into the systems for employees of the post office in the future that haven't been paid. Ironically, a law that was supposed to protect the future of the Postal Service is killing it now.
So
that's been taken off, the explanation of the Postal Service's problem. And then you talk about the Internet. There is about 60% of the American public do not have access to broadband Internet processes. Rural communities don't have it. You can't text a parcel. There's so much more. And as far as alternatives are concerned, there's some good bills that have been introduced in Congress. H.R. 1351, 91, for instance, which gives an immediate fix, prevents post office closures, maintains the service standards. I don't understand how the Postal Service can say that they want to improve things, and then they undermine service.
You know, I have another question. You mentioned the retirement, and we know one of the reasons, or I read one of the reasons, that the Postal Service is the loss that was on their books this past year wasn't so high because the government did let them delay making this payment to the retirement fund. So are you saying that the loss is here? It's all an accrued retirement?
Well, when you consider that we have actually overpaid into the federal retirement system by as much as $11 billion, and two audits have revealed that we've paid from $50 to $70 billion over into the civil service retirement, some of that money should be credited back to the Postal Service. What they've imposed for a company or an agency in 10 years to pre-fund 75 years into the future is a burden that's not posed on any other agency or company for that matter.
But, okay, now you're saying this is something that the government has imposed on the Postal Service. Mr. Wigdall, do you have any other options if this is something that the government has imposed on the Postal Service? Is this the sort of thing that you're talking about that maybe Congress can take some action to kind of help or with some of the pain, financial pain that you're feeling?
Yes, I agree with Omar. Because of the Postal Law of 2006, we're required to pay $5.5 billion a year into our future retiree health care benefits. And that's one of the things that we would like relief from Congress. As I mentioned earlier, there's things that are within our control and things that are within the control of Congress. Retiree health care benefits, we've asked them for a couple of years now for relief on having to pay that. And you're absolutely right, Juanita. We were given a deferment on the payment of the $5.5 billion for fiscal year 2011. That was deferred out to August of next year. So without paying that $5.5 billion, we still lost $5.1 billion last year. So the trend is not good for the Postal Service.
No, either way you look at it, like you said, things have changed. I mean, years ago, you didn't have the Internet. You didn't have online banking. But, you know, a lot of people still depend on the mail, you know. Let's just go back to Christmas. I know I'm standing in line at the Postal Service and all these people, you know, have their Christmas cards and their Christmas packages, you know, that they're trying to get out. And so many of them are used to going to a center in their own neighborhood. I mean, for people to wake up one day and that to be gone, that would be a huge loss.
Well, we're not closing the entire Postal Service, and what we're simply doing is looking at you know how many people are using the Postal Service, what are the future trends of people using the service, and we're actually expanding access to our postal services and products. There's about 100,000 places nationwide that people can buy stamps and other postal services and products. 32,000 of those, of course, are brick-and-mortar post offices, but people can buy stamps online. They can go to USPS.com, and as Mr. Gonzalez said, not everybody has access to a computer, but there are many people that do. People can go to their local drugstore, ATMs, to buy stamps. I mean, there's a number of places that people can buy postal services and products, and that's not going away. What's going away is the mail processing network that we have, this, you know, it's let me just say this, that the mail processing network that we have today is designed to process and deliver about 300 billion pieces of mail a year. As I said earlier, last year we're down to 168 billion pieces, so we have a very large network which largely goes unused, and what we're trying to do is just become more efficient for the long term.
Now, do you feel that if indeed you put into place a number of these efficiencies that you're talking about, do you think that the Postal Service then will be able to sustain itself, or in a few years will you be right back kind of where you are today?
Well, we're planning for the long term, and like I said, we want to take about $20 billion worth of costs out of the system by 2013 to become sustainable, and we haven't been resting on our laurels. I mean, we saw this coming. We saw the the decline in first-class mail volume happening, and over the last 4 years, over the last 4 years, we've taken about $11 billion worth of costs out of the system. We're our employee numbers are down about 110,000 people, and all without doing any layoffs, strictly through attrition. We've closed several mail processing plants over the last 4 years, and some smaller post offices. So we are taking costs out of the system. We just need to continue to do that to face the new reality for the Postal Service.
Now, Mr. Johnson, I'd like to bring you back into the conversation. How important do you feel that this processing center in Bakersfield is to the city? Other than, do you see other benefits other than the employees that and the people who are put to work?
Yeah, there's other benefits as well. Local nonprofits, other local government entities, they all depend on the U.S. Postal Service and the first-class mail. So our nonprofit groups right now, they can go ahead and they can use bulk rate mail, and they get a certain reduction if they process it at the local processing facility. Once that goes away, it's going to increase the cost of postage, I believe, 6 cents. Now, we were told at the meeting that that's going to stay in place for at least 1 year, but, you know, what happens after that 1 year? And that's a significant increase to our local nonprofits that do tons of good work in our community that fill that gap where government drops off and where folks need help. And that's where local nonprofits step up. I'd also like to add, Juanita, that, you know, from my perspective as a city councilman, one of seven in the city of Bakersfield, the postal decision to close the mail processing facility at the city of Bakersfield is just the wrong decision. You're going to have problems with the Ridge Route. It's going to potentially close, and that's going to delay mail even more. Even, I think, the logic may be flawed to move to a 2 to 3 day delivery cycle. When your profit center is based on a 1 day delivery model, and that's your number one profit center, you're going to drive people away from that. Secondly, I think the Postal Service needs to take a good hard look at how they can bring people back to that profit center. And the one way to look at that is look at how many people that are unbanked, and especially in the rural areas in Kern County and up and down the valley, these people are unbanked. They don't have bank accounts. They go to a window, and they pay their PG&E bill. They pay their water bill. The Postal Service needs to adapt. And no one, I think, would argue that the Postal Service needs to make changes. They do. But they need to adapt and realize, okay, we're losing market share for first-class mail because these people are paying their bills at windows. How do we bring them back, and how do we get these people? So maybe we offer that service so people can pay their bills at the U.S. Postal Service instead of losing it to the grocery stores and the windows where people can go and pay their bills now.
You know, Mr. Wigdell, Mr. Johnson did make some valid points, starting with the fact that we know what kind of weather problems and other problems we can have on the Ridge Route, that sometimes it is closed and that could slow up mail delivery. And here in the Central Valley, we do have, the Central Valley is different from the rest of the state. And when he talked about having people here in the rural areas that are unbanked and maybe taking advantage of that, is it the idea, is it tougher to try to put something together region by region, or is this just a decision that you've got to look across the country, we've got to do this, and you don't have the opportunity to take in consideration area by area?
Well, it is a national initiative, the AMP process that we're going through right now. And just getting back to, you know, to the roads that are traveled between Bakersfield and more southern California, say Santa Clarita, I mean, we travel those roads every day today. I mean, we bring that mail between Santa Clarita and Bakersfield. We go from Bakersfield to the Los Angeles airport when we have to send mail across the country or internationally. I mean, we've been able to deal with bad roads in the past, and there's always a way to get the mail through. I mean, keep in mind we deliver mail to the bottom of the Grand Canyon and all the way, you know, to the remotest regions of Alaska, and we get the mail through. So those are taken into consideration. But you know, we've been around for over 235 years, and we're pretty good at what we do. And as far as bringing people to the Postal Service, I mean, we strive for service. And again, you know, it's kind of like a maybe it seems counterintuitive by reducing the number of delivery days to try and bring people to the Postal Service. But, I mean, we do a good job. I mean, all of our employees, and I'm sure Omar will agree with me, that all of our employees do a great job, and we emphasize service and keeping the mail flowing and getting it through. And I know, you know, during earthquakes, during inclement weather that, for example, the Sierra Coastal region had recently with the Santa Ana, or I believe it was the Santa Ana winds, I mean, we had employees casing mail out in parking lots because the lights were out in the buildings, but we got the mail through. So we will do a good job, and we will continue to do a good job and hopefully attract new customers.
Well, we'll just wait and see. We're waiting for whether or not Congress is going to come up with any alternatives or solutions for the Postal Service by May. And whether or not these changes will go through permanently. I'd like to thank James Wigdell with the U.S. Postal Service, also Omar Gonzalez with the American Postal Workers Union, and Russell Johnson, Bakersfield City Councilman. I would like to thank all of you for joining us in this discussion.
Our pleasure.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Late last month, the California Supreme Court ruled that the state could go ahead with Governor Jerry Brown's planned elimination of hundreds of redevelopment agencies. It was a major victory for the governor in his quest to balance the state's budget and a defeat for many cities, which had fought hard for the programs that have helped revitalize inner cities and spur private investment in blighted areas. In a few minutes, we will talk with Fresno Redevelopment Agency Vice Chair Larry Westerlund. But right now, here's FM 89's Joe Moore with a look at this often overlooked part of California's system of government.
At the start of 2012, California had over 5,000 local governments, from counties and cities to school and fire districts. But this February, over 400 of those governments are slated to disappear almost overnight as the state officially closes the book on local redevelopment agencies. It's the latest move in the effort by Sacramento lawmakers to find a new way to balance the state's budget and shift $1.7 billion from community redevelopment agencies, or RDAs as they're often known, to the state's general fund.
It's really about the money. You know, the state in its fiscal crisis, you know, is upset that across the state, 12% of the property taxes are being collected and utilized locally in redevelopment for local purposes.
That's Donna Coons, Community and Economic Development Director for the City of Bakersfield. But what exactly is redevelopment, other than one of the least understood parts of government? It all began in the years after World War II, when California's cities looked for ways to deal with blighted older neighborhoods and declining property values. The legislature authorized the formation of RDAs to provide financial incentives for new development, using the proceeds from future property tax dollars, something called tax increment. Here's former California Deputy Treasurer Mark Paul.
What happens is a cap is placed on the property tax that come from the properties in that area. And all subsequent increases in property taxes from that area, instead of going to the school or the county or the city government, flow to the redevelopment agency.
And agencies would use that money on everything from buying land to resell to developers to funding affordable housing or replacing old water and sewer infrastructure. The new developments funded by RDAs would have a higher assessed value than the old blighted conditions, and that additional property tax revenue would, over years, pay off the debt incurred to provide the incentive. Agencies overall have broad powers and can issue bonds without getting voter approval and can exercise eminent domain.
So it's hidden in the background with money that sort of shut it around out of sight, and that one of the reasons why it's become so enormously popular with local officials, because it allows them to do things that otherwise they wouldn't be able, probably be able to do.
Cities up and down the valley have made extensive use of redevelopment funds in revitalizing older parts of town, from Mill Creek Park in Bakersfield to Chukchansey Park in Fresno. So why are those incentives necessary in the first place? It turns out that it often costs more to build in an older established area than it does on the edge of town, and redevelopment dollars have been effective in generating new investment and affordable housing in otherwise depressed areas.
What you have in downtown are the infrastructure that was built 50, 60, sometimes even up to 100 years ago cannot meet the needs. For example, a major water line might be in excess of $1 million cost.
And costs like that, when combined with high land values compared with land on the urban fringe, makes building downtown more expensive.
So until recently, land prices have been a lot more expensive in our downtown, and rents are typically lower than other parts of town. So that creates an economic challenge to develop in those areas.
That's Darius Asimi, president of Granville Homes, a Fresno developer who has completed a number of mixed-use projects in the Mural District north of the Fulton Mall with RDA support. Asimi, whose company is also a corporate sponsor of this station, says redevelopment has been an important tool in helping to revitalize downtown, helping to close the gap and make downtown more financially competitive. And while agencies in other parts of the state have been criticized for lavish spending on things like golf courses and a mermaid bar, Asimi says that hasn't been the case here in the Valley.
The Fresno RDA has done an excellent job in getting projects out of the ground that would not have otherwise had the opportunity to get built. And Ironbird Lofts, Fulton Village, Broadway Lofts that Reza built are great examples of what the RDA has done here in Fresno.
So how did a program that was so popular with cities up and down the state get almost completely dismantled last month? For years, Sacramento made up for the property tax revenue that would have otherwise gone directly to schools and other local governments. All that changed in the final years of Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's administration, when record budget deficits became the norm and the legislature turned to redevelopment agencies and their billions as a possible solution.
You say under Schwarzenegger, the state started to say, we're not going to let you do that anymore because we don't have the money anymore to backfill.
Unhappy with what they perceived as Sacramento taking local money, in fall 2010, the agency took the issue straight to California voters.
So the redevelopment agencies responded with Proposition 22, which said said that the legislature no more could stop those diversions from happening.
So if the legislature couldn't stop the diversions, Governor Brown decided that the way around Prop 22 was to end the agencies altogether. When the legislature approved Governor Brown's budget last year, it voted to end redevelopment agencies, but in a companion bill allowed them to continue in a reduced form if they agreed to make additional payments to schools and local governments. The agencies claimed this was a violation of the voter-approved Proposition 22, and the issue wound up before the California Supreme Court. On December 29th of last year, the justices ruled that the bill which eliminated the agencies was constitutional, but the companion bill, which allowed them to continue, was a violation of Proposition 22, effectively closing down the agencies in February. So what does this mean for the Valley, and development in local downtowns. We asked Donna Coons.
You know, the loss of redevelopment is losing a critical tool chest that we have used in the past. What's going to happen is going to slow things down.
But while the agencies are closing down soon, some of their projects will continue.
It does provide for redevelopment agencies across the state to finish projects that they had underway and under what they call an enforceable obligation contract.
Daria Sassimi says that while this move may make some projects more challenging to build, there's already a lot of momentum in downtown revitalization that won't go away.
So the mural district is slowly taking shape, and we think that we're almost at a tipping point where there's great entertainment venues, great choice and new architecture.
But one thing is certain, the current shakeup and redevelopment is a big change for local government. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Joe Moore.
And here to discuss what impact that court ruling will have on Fresno's redevelopment agency as well as the state's budget is Fresno City Councilman Larry Westerlund. He is the vice chair of the local agency. And Oliver Baines is the current chair of the RDA. Let me begin with you, City Councilman Baines. Now, you represent District 3, which includes West Fresno and parts of downtown. An area that is being transformed with redevelopment funding. Are you concerned about this and what kind of impact it could have?
Certainly. I do represent some of the most impoverished areas in the country. And the redevelopment agency dollars have been direct benefits and direct infusions to my neighborhoods.
Is there anything you will be able to do? Will you continue to work to try to ensure that the city continues its commitment to these disadvantaged areas of Fresno?
Oh, of course, of course. I don't want anyone listening to think that we, my colleagues and I and the mayor, are not going to be intensely focused on continuing the efforts of redevelopment. What this does, though, is this makes the likely outcome and what we want to accomplish puts at a much longer time frame. And we're talking about areas that have been disadvantaged for the last four or five decades, and just now are beginning to really get some momentum going. So the fact that the governor and the legislature would take this very important tool away, kind of a throw the baby out with the bathwater type scenario, is very disturbing. But we're going to do everything we can to continue to work, to be creative, but it makes it a lot more challenging. And the upsetting piece of this for a council member like myself, and I'm sure my colleague, Member Westerlund, will echo this, is that as they wanted to dissolve the redevelopment agencies, there was no foresight or even thought of, well, how are we going to do the work? How are cities going to continue to do the work that redevelopment agencies do? Because the work that redevelopment agencies do are important for cities like Fresno. We have a very responsible redevelopment agency, and some of the charges that have been levied against other agencies throughout the state were not true in Fresno. We've operated very, very responsibly, and quite honestly, we're very proud of our redevelopment agency, and it comes as a shock to us that they would not take some of the successful redevelopment agencies and use those as models maybe to reform redevelopment agencies instead of completely go away with them. Because the reality is we still need the services provided by redevelopment agencies. My district will still need a redevelopment agency. And without that tool, it makes it that much more difficult to get things done.
Okay, Mr. Baines, I understand that you do have another commitment, but we'd like to thank you for taking this time this morning to join us and to discuss this issue.
I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate you all bringing some awareness to this, and hopefully through the next several months of dialogue, maybe we can see if there can be some type of resolution to this and not where we are without redevelopment agencies for the foreseeable future, because we need something like a redevelopment agency for areas that are impoverished in Fresno, like West Fresno, the downtown area, that make it hard for development, as you listen to Darius talk about. I mean, those communities deserve an opportunity too. So, and that's really what redevelopment agency stood for. So thank you for your time, and I'm sorry, I have a commitment waiting for me in the lobby now, so I'm gonna check off, but you're really in really good hands with Councilmember Larry Westerlund, who is really on the forefront of understanding the complexity of the court case and being a champion for redevelopment agencies. And we've been very lucky on the Fresno City Council to have him working with us.
Okay. Well, thank you. And Councilman Westerlund, last year as the chair, you did go to Sacramento and really lobby on behalf of Fresno's effort. What do you think, what kind of impact are we looking at here? And what do you think it's going to take to really continue the efforts to revitalize certain areas?
Well, good morning, first of all.
Good morning, so, thank you.
Thank you for having me here. I appreciate the opportunity, and it has been an honor to work on redevelopment and redevelopment projects for the last 7 years that I've been on the council. But to get to your question, I think Councilmember Baines was optimistic when he said, you know, we're going to continue to work on stuff. We will try to. But with this tool gone from the toolbox, redevelopment agency, you know, our chances of making progress in some areas of Fresno, some of the heavily blighted areas, I think is practically nil.
Wow.
I mean, you might as well find some areas, find some bubble wrap, encapsulate them in bubble wrap and then break them out in 15 or 20 years. And everybody says it's going to make the process slower. I totally disagree. It's going to kill the process.
It will kill them.
Absolutely.
Because nobody has money.
Exactly. The state doesn't have any money, so we're not going to get any grant money from the state to redevelop or revitalize particular areas. There's no money at the federal level to come in and redo a community block grant money or anything like that. And there's no money at the local level. You know, more and more redevelopment agencies were backfilling public works that normally would have been done by the city as a public works project. So let's say you need to resurface a city or a city street in downtown Fresno or in West Fresno. The money that was coming to do that more and more and more was from the redevelopment tax increment because there's no money in the public works department of the city of Fresno. So this is really truly going to kill redevelopment and revitalization of older neighborhoods up and down the state of California. No doubt about it.
Well, you know, first of all, let's kind of take a look at the projects that are in the works. Now, last year when the cities learned that the state was looking to disband RDAs, this city council, like those around the state, rushed to approve a number of projects so they could kind of like keep that money. Now, do you have the money for those projects?
Well, the bill, AB 26, allows for the projects that were already done and then there was an enforceable obligation contract that we continue to collect that tax increment in the succeeding agency or the successor agency is the language that they're going to use. And we have contracts with third parties, and this is what we did that was, I thought, quite a bit more responsible and quite a bit different than places like Los Angeles or San Diego, is that we didn't go contract with the city of Fresno. They took their redevelopment agency, which is a separate legal entity, and they said, well, we're going to contract with the city of San Diego or the city of Los Angeles, or in our case, it would have been the city of Fresno, and we're going to say that's an enforceable obligation. Well, AB 26 clearly says, look, you guys are related entities. You can't play this shell game and say this is an enforceable obligation. So they throw those out. We did about 24 projects that were all in the pipeline. We pushed them up into the pipeline, but they're all projects with third parties, Darius has seen me, other folks that are doing development projects in downtown Fresno. And those obligations should stand up to scrutiny because they are real. They are truly an enforceable obligation that we need to honor. And we'll get the tax increment continuing to go forward for those two dozen or so projects.
Okay. Now, one of the things is that many cities thought that the courts would uphold a portion of the law that stated that the cities could maintain their redevelopment agencies if they paid money, about $1.7 billion, that would go to schools. Now, the court said no to that. So where does that leave the cities? I'd like to bring in columnist Dan Walters with the Sacramento Bee. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Walters.
You're welcome.
Now, do you think the legislator will come? Legislators will come up with any kind of alternative so cities can keep their redevelopment agencies?
I think there'll be an effort of that kind, and it may not even be called redevelopment. But you're operating here in a pretty narrow range because the redevelopment agencies take about $5 billion a year in property taxes, and probably close to $3 billion of that is needed to service its outstanding debt. So it only leaves about a $2 billion window there, so to speak. And the state wants that money. They want that money, and they offered the cities the option of keeping redevelopment if they give them the money, essentially. The cities filed suit and lost, and that issue hinged on the ballot measure that the cities themselves sponsored last year. So the escape clause to keep redevelopment alive was killed by the city's own ballot measure, which is irony upon ironies. Yes, there will be an effort to try to keep something alive. There's kicking around things like improvement districts and low-income housing, particularly. But the dollars will drive the thing. And when you take out the money that's needed to service debt, it doesn't leave an awful lot there to be, and the money that the state insists it's going to have out of this pot, this $5 billion pot, there's not a lot of room there for doing anything else. And so it's going to be a very difficult thing. And the governor doesn't seem to be very interested in doing anything like that. He seems to want the cities to go look for new ways to do their whatever they want to do without indirectly tapping into the state treasury, which is what redevelopment has done through a very convoluted financial structure. And there's not a lot of room there for maneuver, it seemed to me.
Now, Dan, is that something you see too? Because a lot of people are maybe holding out hope that they were holding out hope that the legislators would do something to try to keep that alive for cities. But you know, if it doesn't that kind of leave you guys holding the bag? Aren't there projects out there that you have started that you need those funds for? Or?
Well, there's certainly lots of projects that we would like to do. Good projects, strong economically development projects. Because we didn't not only do housing projects, but we also helped heavy industrial folks come in, clean up their areas, and be able to create jobs in a place like Fresno is incredibly important. But I agree with Mr. Walters. I think the governor's not going to be interested. He's gotten his hands on the money. I think he's going to be very reluctant to part with even a small portion of that in the way that it's come out of the state treasury. That being said, I'd like to think that there are and I know there are legislators out there who represent areas of real depressed property values and heavily blighted areas that they realize that their districts aren't going to get any better without some sort of assistance. Now, maybe they're going to come back and say, well, cities, you need to go directly to your voters and ask for a bump up in sales tax or something like that. But in the climate that we see things today economically, that's just not going to happen.
Now, Mr. Walters, you do support RDAs, but with changes. What changes do you think need to be made?
I think it would be too safe that I'm support RDAs. I think some form of that should be reinstituted, but in a very tight sort of vein. Look, RDAs created their own problem. Not only did they proliferate like crazy over the state, but they veered away from their original mission of cleaning up blight to become essentially business partners with developers for big box stores and auto malls and that sort of thing. And in so doing, created these fanciful blight designations that just simply did not wash. And so they created their own problem, PR problem, if you will, political problem, if you will, and then expanded their take of property taxes that schools and counties and the state itself coveted. There should be a way for cities to clean up blight. and that's a good thing to do. But it's not. That's different than going out and saying taking some farmland and creating an auto mall or something like that, which is what the redevelopment's been used in many cases for. And it has to be tightened up, and the RDAs have to clean up their own act. They've got to stop looking for ways to get around the blight designation and getting around this stuff and declaring whole cities to be redevelopment areas and making deals with stadium developers and things like that. They've got to throttle back and stop being these kind of high-flying, I'll take the land if I want to, I don't give a damn sort of agencies, and start going back to their roots of what they were supposed to be doing and once did before redevelopment became this big thing after Proposition 13 passed in 1978.
Okay, Larry, I'll let you have the last say. We're almost out of time.
Sure. No, you know, I can't disagree with Mr. Walters on this. There certainly were lots of agencies that took a very liberal interpretation of stuff and did things that just weren't appropriate and beyond the scope of what redevelopment agents were. But for places like Fresno, right, and some other places that didn't take those and didn't do those kinds of things, you know, didn't try to designate 20 acres of Thompson seedless grapes as a blight area, you know, this is our only tool to deal with blight.
Yeah.
And this is going to be a very, very sore loss for the city of Fresno and cities up and down, particularly the Central Valley, for decades to come if something isn't able to happen that allows us to keep some semblance of that going forward.
Okay. Well, thank you both. Mr. Walters, yes, columnist with the Sacramento Bee, thanks so much for joining us this morning, as well as Larry Westerlin, Fresno City Councilman with the District 5. Thanks a lot for being here. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. Heinz Hospice is an organization that is a blessing to so many Valley residents. Its mission is to uphold the dignity and ease the suffering of the terminally ill while supporting their loved ones and those who are grieving. Now, the hospice serves Fresno, Madera, and Merced counties and depends on a host of volunteers to help provide those services. Here to discuss how you can help is Samantha Hsu, Director of Community and Fund Development, and Lauren Gaither, Funds Development Coordinator with Heinz Hospice. Really, you cover a wide area. Just how important are volunteers for your operation?
I would say volunteers allow us to do what we do. They allow us to provide the care to the families and to the patients. We wouldn't be here without them. So absolutely vital.
About how many volunteers work with the agency?
We have over 300 volunteers, from patient care volunteers, clerical volunteers, fund development volunteers, thrift store volunteers. We have them in all areas of our agency.
Now, what are some of the services you provide? Because you really have so many of us who, you know, remember when, you know, Nancy started Heinz Hospice. Mm-hmm. You have grown so much since then. What are some of the other services that you now provide?
So in addition to our hospice home here on Twain, we also care for patients in their own home. We see over 100 patients every day in their own home between Fresno, Madera, and Merced counties. One of the things that we do need volunteers for are the volunteers in those outlying areas to help us with the patients who live, you know, in Shaver Lake and Squaw Valley and Mendota and all these kind of far areas of the county, because those are underserved populations and we do need volunteers in those areas. We also provide, we have a multicultural outreach program, pediatric hospice. We're the area's only perinatal hospice and bereavement program for patients. That's called Angel Babies.
Angel Babies. Mm-hmm. What a great
yeah,
service that you provide. I had an opportunity to do a story last year about mm-hmm. Angel Babies. And the people that I met, they are just, that service means everything to them.
It's very special.
It really is. And, well, you know, you talk about Angel Babies. Maybe people aren't familiar with that, but it really does help parents when they lose a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we provide the bereavement support and memory-making support. And, you know, we go in there oftentimes when, you know, a family is either in the hospital and it's the diagnosis is first been given, or, you know, during labor and they discover something's wrong. You know, we have social workers that will go out there and counselors that will provide support for the family. And we continue to provide support, you know, after the baby's gone. So we're the only, you know, service like that in the Central Valley and possibly California. So,
well, really, you do when you look at the area that you serve, but you do have people from all over the Central Valley because people know about Heinz Hospice who really, you know, seek you out.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, our level of care and just, you know, the fact that we look at our patients and we want to provide the absolute best care for our patients and our families, and that comes before everything. And so, you know, that's why, you know, the volunteers are so important to do that, because we wouldn't be able to do that without their support.
Do you have any efforts coming up that are about, you know, trying to increase your volunteers or increase your funding? I know Heinz Hospice mm-hmm. is always, you know, in need.
Well, we are getting ready. We're actually kicking off our first ever annual campaign, and that's going to utilize about 100 brand new volunteers. So we're very excited about that. That's going to kick off in March, and we're just starting the kickoff activities now. And we're hoping to raise $200,000 from that to help support our patient care.
So this is your first ever.
This is our first ever in 30 years. This is our first ever formal annual campaign. It's awesome.
The people that you're going to need to mount this campaign, have you started contacting them yet? Or like you said, you're going to need volunteers for that effort alone.
Yeah. So far right now, it's word of mouth. We've got some people in charge of it who've kind of been putting their feelers out. You know how it goes. And they are forming teams is what's happening. And we're hoping to have 10 teams of 10 out raising money in the community.
Okay, that sounds great. Something to look forward to. Mm-hmm. You said in March?
Yeah, that kicks off in March. We're starting the process. You know, we're kind of in the planning stages right now. So if anybody wants information, they can certainly contact us. And then we're also getting ready to do a new patient care volunteer training. I believe that's also in March as well.
For people who want to participate and who want to help, what can they do? Now, like you mentioned, you're getting ready. They do go through training, correct?
Yes, actually. Well, the first thing is they're more than welcome to come to an informational meeting. And informational meetings are held the last Thursday of every month. So this one will be January 26th, and it's at 5 p.m. at our offices. And that's 1616 West Shaw, and that's Suite A5. And they can come, and we tell them about all the different ways they could volunteer or get involved. Obviously, patient volunteers is one of those common volunteer programs that people understand. But there's so many different ways that you can volunteer for Heinz Hospice. And so we talk about that. And then if they're interested, they go to a 3-day training, and it takes place over the course of 3 weeks, and it's 1 day a week. And so it's pretty comprehensive, but it's, you know, as Nancy Heinz likes to say, it's really training for life. It's one of those things that covers everything from, you know, the bereavement support and what we do and all about the different programs that we provide.
And for people who want more information, should they go to your website? Will it be there, or is there another?
Yeah, our website's got a lot of information, but I would just encourage them to call our office at 320-0308 and speak with one of the volunteer coordinators.
Okay. Well, thank you both for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us.
Oh, you're so welcome. Samantha Hsu and Lauren Gaither, both with Heinz Hospice. And they are looking for volunteers to help, so give them a call for that. Thank you both for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Cahuilla Delta Medical Center, and Kaiser Permanente.